Jeff Collins is a professor of Old Testament at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. There are many reasons why Jack is right at home with the ASA, in addition to being an important voice in the theology-science dialogue and having contributed to the ASA journal. Jack has a bachelor's and master's degree from MIT in computer science and systems engineering. So apparently it's not too much of a jump from there to the world of interpreting ancient languages. He completed his PhD at the School of Archaeology and Oriental Studies at the University of Liverpool, and he's been at Covenant since 1993.
Yes, that's right.
Jack served as the Old Testament Chair on the Translation Committee for the English Standard Version of the Bible and was Old Testament Editor for the ESV Study Bible. He's the author of several books, including Genesis 1 through 4, a linguistic, literary, and theological commentary, The God of Miracles, an exegetical examination of God's action in the world, Did Adam and Eve Really Exist?, Who They Were and Why You Should Care, and this book, Science and Faith, Friends or Foes, which I brought so you could sign. I just mentioned that G.I. Packer endorsed it as interesting, fair-minded, shrewd, and clear from start to finish. And I also found on the internet that a prominent international creation ministry reviewed it as sloppy, lazy, and dishonest.
Right. Oh, yeah.
That's the ultimate accolade.
I wear it as a badge of honor. He is currently on a sabbatical leave of sorts from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School as a visiting scholar in the Creation Project of the Carl F. H. Henry Center for Theological Understanding. And tonight he's here with his wife, Diane. She there, that's in the back. Welcome. So please welcome Dr. Collins.
Thank you very much. It is a treat to be here. And as Steve said, I am working with the Creation Project at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School over in Deerfield. And as a matter of fact, my three colleagues, my fellows, if you like, are also here. There's Todd Patterson over there. There's John Hilber there and Clinton Ohlers. And so all four of us are working with the Creation Project at TEDS. This is a project that is funded by the Templeton Foundation, and it's over the course of 3 years where the major part of this is to have resident research fellows who will be studying aspects, and the topic will change as the years progress. In this particular year, we're studying aspects of the interpretation of Genesis 1 through 11. And so that's what I'm doing here, and I will be in this area for the entire academic year. That's what my normal workday looks like, it's I'm accustomed to spending my workdays in front of a classroom, and so I don't know that I will be able to go back, we'll see. Let me go back to my title. Genesis 1 through 11, Poetry, History, Science, Truth, Reading Well with Help from C.S. Lewis. So that's the title of my research project. And what I want to do is give you an idea of what it is overall that I'm doing, give you some ideas of what I think are the contributions that I'm hoping to make. And I'll finish with some discussion of a very specific subject, namely God's action in the world, particularly in the activities of creation. And are we able to talk about that in a meaningful and helpful way? And that, you know, comes to bear on a lot of things that we think about in the ASA about origins and so forth. So all of us are familiar with people who would say things like, how can you say that you believe the Bible when you don't accept what it plainly says about the age of the earth and the origin of species? That's what gets people's books reviewed as sloppy, lazy, and dishonest, I suppose. But the argument is that the foundation of all these things that are quite important to us, the meaning of life, moral standards, integrity of marriage, and so on and so forth, all depend on the way in which we read Genesis. But we get other inputs as well. Why would you bother to base your life on an ancient book like the Bible? The writers thought the world was flat and that the sky was a dome. What's the point of paying any attention to them at all? A little bit closer to home would be this comment here from a book on geology. The ancient world universally believed that the dome-like vault of the sky is a glassy crystalline solid. Some commentators attempt to avoid the force of the statement by claiming that Scripture is using phenomenal language, the language of appearance. But that's our problem. The Israelites would not have seen it that way. The sky didn't just look solid to them. They believed it to be a solid. Now, that comes from Young and Sterley's book, The Bible, Rocks, and Time. And even though I don't think that statement is quite satisfactory, I will point out that the very first endorsement in the front cover comes from me. So I don't think that defeats the usefulness of the book, but I do think that one can push back a little bit on that kind of sentiment. So the issues boil down to, what does it mean to be a good reader of the biblical material? What does it actually mean to cooperate with the kind of thing that we have, whether it be Genesis 1 through 11, whether it be Exodus 20 and the Ten Commandments, or a gospel account, a letter of Paul, or the book of Revelation? You take your choice. What does it mean to be a good reader of these things? Or, and this is what we encounter in our culture, both from, shall we say, the right and the left, the first two quotes that I gave you, is the reading strategy self-evident? Namely, you read it in a very literalistic fashion, and anything else is shilly-shallying with the words. And is any attempt then at explaining it simply explaining away? And this is where people get nervous, or perhaps they get filled with disdain toward us if we try to explain things. So what I'm doing in my project is to draw from three areas: linguistics, rhetoric, and literary theory. Linguistics is the study of language, but in particular, you have in linguistics a number of topics like phonology. What are the sounds of one language? And of course, if you learn another language, you realize that each language has its own distinct set of sounds. And even dialects of any language have their distinct sets of sounds. I cannot mimic satisfactorily a British accent, because it's very hard for me to make the vowels the way that they do. So each language has its own distinct way of approaching its sounds. Each language has, there's a variety of writing systems. In the ancient world, each language did have its own writing system. Thankfully, we have fewer choices available to us now, which is good. But each language also has its own vocabulary. That's part of what makes it hard to learn another language, is learning the new words. It has its own syntax, the grammar, the way you put words together. But languages go further than just what the sentences do. You use sentences to do things to people. Probably if you have had children, or if you've been a child, so I think that covers everybody, you have the experience of sitting down at the dinner table, and somebody, now it's usually the oldest male in the room, that's a sociological fact, it's usually the oldest male, will make an observation like, there's no salt on the table. And if you're just looking at the words, it sounds like an observation about the world. Maybe it's a celebration that somebody cleared off the salt crystals or something like that. But of course, the words are being used to do something, namely to urge, usually the youngest child present, to get up from the table and fetch the salt shaker or the salt cellar, whatever you use in your family. So there's an area of linguistics called pragmatics, how people use language to do things. And that also then comes into what's called sociolinguistics, how language functions in a culture. You know, so that there are ways of speaking. For example, in a classroom, if you're the teacher in a classroom, you have power, and you have ways of wielding power, and sometimes you're not aware of it, sometimes you are, and so people, you know, discuss those things and study those things. So the area of linguistics called pragmatics is an area that I am trying to mine for resources for good reading, because if Genesis is sacred scripture, it is designed to do something in the audience of the book, to do something to the audience, to shape them. And so the question of how it does so is something that linguistic pragmatics can help us with. The traditional discipline of rhetoric is also aiming at how people use their language to shape a response. Now, I have to apologize. The word rhetoric has become, you know, one of those funny words in our culture. Rhetoric, semantics, and politics are three words that they actually are all very similar in their derivation from Greek adjectives, but they're used now as sort of dismissive. That's just rhetoric. That's just politics, and so forth. But as a matter of fact, the discipline of rhetorical study is oriented towards discerning the ways in which people use language to shape a response. So, for example, if you were talking about me, you could say that guy. You could refer to me as that fundamentalist Bible professor. I mean, you could use a lot of different titles for describing the same thing, and all of them, you know, would have their validity. Or potential validity, anyhow. But the way you choose to name me shapes the way that your it's your effort at shaping the way that your audience will respond to me or think about me. So rhetoric is interested in things like that. And then literary theory, namely, since Genesis comes to us as literature, how does literature work? And there have been lots of advances in literary theory in, say, the last 50 years, as applied to the Bible, especially the way in which the Bible writers work with this very understated style that expects you to engage and to analyze and show. They're showing rather than telling, and so forth. Things that I could get into in more detail, but I will in the monograph that I write. But I'm going to go quickly now, just because I am aware of limitations of time and so forth. But I want to take all of these things and bring them to bear on developing a rigorous reading strategy for Genesis 1 through 11. Now, it turns out that all three of these disciplines, if you go to a university or a college, all three of these disciplines will be in separate departments. And actually, they might even be in separate schools or colleges of the university. I mean, that's the way things work. But I'm sort of taking the approach that what God has joined together, man must not separate. And there's loads of ways in which these disciplines overlap and also mutually help one another. And so I'm working in the area of the overlap. They all lead us to ask questions. When you come to a text, what kind of a text is this? What is its thingishness? How does a psalm differ from an oracle from a prophet, which differs from, say, a genealogy that opens 1 Chronicles and so forth? What authority relationship exists between the author and the audience? What setting does the text assume by which it is to be received? That is to say, is it something, if it's a psalm, its setting, its assumed setting is that it's something that people would sing together. If it's a text like in the Pentateuch, its assumed setting is that it's something that would be read aloud in a public worship service, and so forth. And so, how does the setting in which it's consumed, how does that affect the way in which we appropriate, lay hold of the text? How does the author choose words and descriptions to influence the dispositional stance of the audience? So you can talk about a Philistine as a Philistine, or you can talk about a Philistine as a Gentile. And you're saying something a little bit stronger if you say a Gentile. And so, you know, why would somebody in the historical books refer to that uncircumcised Philistine? Not because they've been in the locker room together, but rather because of the meaning of that symbol in terms of the social relationships between the parties, the social and religious relationships between the parties. And so they want to say this is a person from outside the people of God. So choice of terminology matters. And then what is this text intended to do to and for its recipients? And then how does the text's organization support or hinder its apparent intended effect? Well, my hero in this is C.S. Lewis. Maybe in this audience, I'm not sure I should say this, but you already said something about a cigar box. So he'd be happy with you using a cigar box, I suppose. But his approach to reading displays the intuitions that lie behind these three disciplines. And he also shows that the disciplinary boundaries are artificial and worthy of transcending. So in my project, I'm finding in C.S. Lewis, particularly what he wrote in his day job as a scholar of medieval and Renaissance English literature, as he reflects on the reading process, I'm finding lots of fruitful ideas there. Let me just give you an example here. The very first sentence in his book, Preface to Paradise Lost, is this. The first qualification for judging any piece of workmanship from a corkscrew to a cathedral is to know what it is, what it was intended to do, and how it is meant to be used. Now, in a way, the statement is, as soon as somebody says it, you're kind of like, of course, it's obvious. But what is striking is how rarely people stop and make themselves ask these questions right at the get-go. That is to say, what it is? What kind of text have we got? What is the relationship of the form and the content? Then what it was intended to do? What effect does the work aim to produce? How it is meant to be used? What kind of users are in view? What knowledge and beliefs do they share? What kind of social setting is the normal use? Things like that. So straight away, Lewis has directed our attention to these topics that I've mentioned are covered by linguistic pragmatics and rhetoric and a literary theory. And he's invited us to reflect with sophistication on the reading process. So this is an overview of my book, 9 chapters. I won't say how I feel about it, but in any case, so just an introduction to set things up, and there's some interesting historical background there, which if you ask me about later, I'll tell you, like Clinton is thinking, don't ask him, because you won't get him to shut up, so I know that they're here to heckle me, so, then I want to get into the question of what's happening in literary communication. Lewis has lots of observations, particularly his preface to Paradise Lost and a few other places. But let's reflect on what's happening in a literary work and what it means to read well and so forth. And just this very question, what is it? What was it intended to do? Is the place to start. Types of language. I'll talk about that in a moment. I'm drawing on another discussion that Lewis has. The fourth is good faith communication. So when I say something, what am I committing myself to if I'm communicating in good faith? So, if I say it is 500 kilometers from St. Louis to Chicago, what would be, how would you gauge whether that's a true statement? It's really a million miles if you're talking baseball, but yes, there's again lots more. But when we talk about whether a statement is true or false, we gauge things according to the circumstances. Is it true or false that St. Louis and Chicago were 500 kilometers apart? Well, it kind of depends on what you're trying to communicate. If I'm trying to give you a rough idea of why I'm not going to drop in on a seminar on a Thursday afternoon in St. Louis because it's a long drive, then giving you that distance is that tells you what you need to know. If I'm trying to help you gauge exactly how long it's going to take you to get there, and how much reimbursement you should be asking for, you know, in your travel expenses. 500 kilometers is not a proper communication. You need something that's more detailed for that particular communication. The fifth chapter, there are three chapters on what do we have in Genesis 1 through 11? The context, how does it work within, it's within itself, what kind of cohesion do you find in the text? How does it fit within Genesis? How does it fit within the entire Pentateuch? But also, what kind of audience is assumed in Genesis? And what difference does that make to us? I'll come back to that in a moment. The second chapter on those is the function. What is it supposed to do? Genesis 1 through 11 is a part of a constitution for a people. So what does that mean about what we do with it? It's a very unusual constitution because the whole Pentateuch is this constitution that is a narrative from beginning to end. And even the specific laws within the Pentateuch, they don't break the narrative. And God said, those are events within the narrative, the speaking of this particular law. So that's really different, say, from the constitution we're used to in this country. So what is that saying? Then other readers, like in the canon, reliable readers and less than reliable readers, say, in Second Temple Judaism, the early church, and so forth. And then the chapter I've been working on today, Genesis 1 through 11, providing a humane vision for the Israelite theocracy. I would like to affect the way that people think about what you have in the Pentateuch as a whole. Christians are uncertain about the Pentateuch, and we think of it as this negative thing. Don't do this, don't do that. If you cross this boundary, you get your throat cut and so forth. The overall function of the Pentateuch is to preserve a safe and healthy community. That's its function. So I want to show how Genesis 1 through 11 fits within that, where this well-functioning community is a community in which true humanity is allowed to flourish, true humanity from which we have fallen. And true humanity, which is being restored through the work of God's gracious making himself known to a community of his people, something that we Christians inherit. Our communities, our churches, we want them to be well-functioning communities where our humanity can flourish. And in that chapter, I'm also going to have a discussion of thinking about divine action, which I may get to tonight, and then my conclusions. So, real briefly, where I think I'm making contributions, and let me just go to the first, and then I'm going to skip to the divine action discussion because I know that time will run away from us. C.S. Lewis has this essay in Christian Reflections called The Language of Religion. It's partial. A couple of pages from the original manuscript are missing, and it looks like it was an early effort at, you know, a draft of a chapter for some work. We know that he and Tolkien intended to write a book on language together, they were never able to do that. So maybe that's what this was originally for. But he asked us to consider these three sentences. It was very cold. There were 13 degrees of frost. And this one, ah, bitter chill it was. The owl for all his feathers was a cold. The hare limped trembling through the frozen grass. And silent was the flock and woolly fold. Numbed were the beadsman's fingers. Now, each of these three sentences is a description of a cold winter night. And each of them is a potentially true description of a cold winter night. But each of them functions differently. And so the way Lewis described it is the sentence, it was very cold, is what we would call ordinary language, what we use in ordinary day-to-day communication. 13 degrees of frost, in Lewis's idiom, that would be 13 degrees below the freezing point. That would be 13 Fahrenheit degrees below the freezing point. You know, just so, you know, and I'm sure you use Celsius here, right? Is that no? Oh, okay. Well, all right. So we're talking about, you know, a night in which it was 19 degrees, okay? So that's cold. And then the poem... The poetic language from Cates is Eve of St. Agnes. is doing something different. And in fact, the poem is throwing at you this rapid fire set of images. The owl was a coal for all, you know, you think of an owl with feathers, and you begin to think of how an owl, you know, fluffs out its feathers. We have an owl in our neighborhood that, you know, you only see it in the winter, and you can see what it does with its feathers. You think of the hare limping, trembling through the frozen grass. It, you know, picks his way carefully because the grass is so stiff. You know, silent was the flock in woolly fold. You know, they're all huddled together, and they don't want to make any noise. Numb were the beadsman's fingers as he's telling his beads. His fingers are cold, so cold that it's hard to tell the rosary. And so, you know, you get these pictures. So each of these are potentially a true description of a cold winter's night, but each of them functions differently. And so Lewis's argument is that you have the ordinary language and then two specializations of ordinary language into either scientific or poetical language. And the point is that each of them does something different. Nobody in their right mind would ask which is better, because the only response to that is better for what? And it kind of depends on what your communicative purpose is. And so the characteristics of the different kinds of language, the scientific language tends to be more analytical. You're making distinctions. It's 19 degrees, not 20 degrees, and something, you know, things will happen to the fluids within plants and so forth at these temperatures. Ordinary language tends to be more phenomenological. That is to say, in ordinary language, we describe things by appearances. That's actually a feature of ordinary language. And you say, as you might, that the children's shoes are getting too small for their feet. Right? I mean, some people, you've said that, right? But if you were being strict, of course, the children's feet are getting too big for the shoes. But the point is, you don't mind using a description of appearance. And as a matter of fact, the description of appearance enables the person to perceive what you're talking about a lot faster than a more technical description. And then the poetical language is more imagistic, whether it's flashing images in front of your mind like the Keats poem is doing, or using metaphors and things like that. So the act of communication involves an author who uses a text to operate on a world that is shared between the author and his audience. And the message is the operation of the text on this shared world. And texts are of different sorts. So if a text comes to you, say, as ordinary language, the way in which it operates on the shared world will be different from the way it would do so if it were a poetical text, and so forth. Part of the research that one does to understand the Bible well is to understand this shared world. If somebody in the Bible talks about a dog, their experience of dogs is different from my experience of dogs. The household dog is a member of the family. Well, you know, you have a different experience in the ancient Near East. So you have to understand that. So if the Bible calls somebody a dog, you know, there's a force behind that. Or the what I used earlier, the uncircumcised Philistine, there are certain assumptions operating within the world. And so that is to say, texts typically say more than just the words in them. And just the words aren't enough to understand how a text is working. And it helps them to understand for a text what kind of language is being used. Now, here's where I'll finish on this section and then go and then talk about divine action, because I have more slides than I have time, and you stayed up late watching the ball game and so forth. So I went to high school in Naperville back in the 60s, by the way. I'm pleased that this is the Wheaton and Naperville chapter. So I was here in 1969 when the Cubs were 8 games ahead of the Mets on September 1st and then folded. And that was the year. That was the first year that the Mets played in the World Series and won. That was the amazing Mets. So I have total sympathy with how people who are local here are feeling, or empathy, I guess, is the thing. Okay, so oftentimes when we're looking at a text, we're asking the question, what's going on in the author's life that makes him produce that? Lewis helps us to appreciate that that's the wrong question. The right question is, what is the author hope? What is the author with this text trying to do to the audience? So he says, all art is made to face the audience. So he's looking at a particular literary device. He's imagining a scene, you know, with a bard and the royal banquet and all that sort of stuff. And so the techniques of composition are not about the bard and his experience of composing the poem. They're rather about the way in which the bard serves his audience. What these things do for the hearers, not what they do for the poet. Let me go very quickly. That's a familiar picture, Okay, so let me give you this picture here. So I was once a much younger man and was invited to give a talk at a conference where the organizers and most of the people attending, let's just say that they had a different view of the timing of creation than I do. And so I was invited to come in as a different voice. And so that picture was taken at roughly the same time as that conference took place. I gave my papers and answered questions and so forth. At a conference like that, everybody thinks they've got the knockdown argument that's going to set you straight and so forth. So, you know, they gather around you afterwards, and you try to explain, you know, you hope it's patient and kind and all that, but you're trying to explain why that argument really doesn't work and so on. So, you know, that was my experience at this conference. When I got home, my children, who were aware of how controversial all this stuff was, and they're very loyal to their dad, which is a good thing to say, they asked me how it went. And what did I tell them? I told them this. There were thousands of them, and they kept on coming, and I kept on swinging. And every time I knocked one down, five more would step up to take his place, but I knocked them down too, and I just kept on swinging. And when it was all over, I was still standing, and there they were lying in heaps at my feet. So I portrayed the setting as if in this case this is Horatio at the bridge from Classics, and obviously portrayed myself as heroic. So I will accept that is morally questionable whether I'm as heroic as I portrayed it. But it was okay for my kids because they enjoyed the portrayal. But with that description, did I tell them the truth? My children would say yes. I told them the truth because there was an actual set of events that they could identify and form pictures of in their minds and interpret those events in the light of the imagery that I used to give them that account. So if we find, as I would argue, we have lots of imagistic description in Genesis, that does not take away from its potential truthfulness. All it does is ask us to be very careful how we interpret it. All right, so let me just go very quickly, because I know, let's see, there we are. So I'm going to talk about God's action in the world that he made. So this will be the last thing I do. I'll run through it quickly. And here's some statements. John Walton, my friend, and I'm sure highly esteemed and so forth. But he does say in his book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, people in the ancient world had no category for what we call natural laws. When they thought in terms of cause and effect, even though they could make all the observations that we make, they were more inclined to see the world's operation in terms of divine cause. Or N.T. Wright saying the very word miracle itself, and for that matter, the words natural and supernatural, are in fact symptomatic of a very different range of possible worldviews from those which were open to Galilean villagers in the first century. And in Wright's estimation, that is unfortunate. Denis Lamoureux, also my friend, with whom I participated in this endeavor, the views of historical Adam, he says in that book, The notion of the immutability of living organisms is clearly present in Genesis 1. That chapter states 10 times that plants and animals reproduce according to its or their kind. Now, just a little heads up. Anytime somebody tells you the Bible clearly says, you need to have a little alarm go off in your mind. Because they're pulling a fast one on you. They don't know it, but I mean, Danny's a good guy. He doesn't mean to do this, but they're making a mistake. In order to be fair and above board with you, the person needs to say, here's what I read the Bible to be saying, and here's why I think you should read the Bible that way also. That is to say, they need to make an argument. Claims that it clearly says are highly suited for discussion and debate, and we're better off leaving them alone. But the whole issue of, you know, the plants and the animals reproduce according to their kinds. And then Rudolf Bultmann, I'll take that at another time. Let me just point out, through audience criticism, audience criticism involves understanding the needs and the situation of the original audience of a text, or at least of the ideal audience. And it's been well discussed that the original audience of the text of Genesis are people who are primarily agricultural peasants. And so, you know, they actually come to the world with a lot of experience of things. For example, they already know how do you get more sheep. You breed them with sheep. They already know how you raise barley. You plant barley seeds. If you plant something else, you're not going to get barley. You know, you have the parable of Jesus, the wheat and the tares. And when two different kinds of plants grow up, what does the farmer say? Somebody has come in and planted something in addition to what I planted. So the people in that world were actually pretty savvy about these day-to-day things. So the question of whether the different kinds reproduce according to their kinds doesn't seem to me to be even an important question to people of that sort, let alone the question of whether one kind can become another kind. These are just extraneous issues to a peasant. What a peasant needs to know is that this is God's world, and these things work because this is God's setup for his world. And exactly what processes led to them being this way is a separate discussion altogether. And it's especially the case in that Genesis is, I'm going to skip ahead. You see I have way too many slides, don't I? Genesis is written to people who already know these things. And it is a very different kettle of fish than Aristotle. Aristotle talks about the immutability of the kinds. And his Greek word for kind is actually very close to the Greek word used in the Greek translation of Genesis for the kinds. Now, Aristotle will give you a reason for the immutability of the kinds. That is to say, Aristotle is a scientific text. Now, we might not agree with Aristotle's explanation. That's a separate question. But it's still a scientific or philosophical text. What you have in Genesis is not that at all. So the issue of what processes might be involved or whether there were processes, you know, how it came to be the case, that's left out entirely. And that's typical of poetical and ordinary language. You don't usually get into how it came to be that way. You just simply look at the way that it is. And the point is that it is God's arrangement. And so the more important thing from Genesis is to instill a worldview in God's people and to do so with a big story. I've got two slides out of order. I apologize for that. So I think C.S. Lewis's notion of evolution is very, very helpful. And it's very sound. It fits with the way I'm saying that Genesis should be read, namely that for the scientist, evolution is a purely biological theorem. It takes over organic life on this planet as a going concern and tries to explain certain changes within that field. It makes no cosmic statements, no metaphysical statements, no eschatological statements. I mean, then we say, yeah, if only. you know, but if a person were sticking to his field, that would be the goal. It does not in itself explain the origin of organic life, nor the variations, nor does it discuss the origin and validity of reason. So if there's other stuff involved in the processes, that's a separate question. You don't know that ahead of time from your study of the natural world. And so the scientific study of kinds and their mutations and so forth, that's a totally legitimate endeavor. But I'll just finish with worldview, and I'm sorry. Something from Lewis: Christianity going on from the Hebrew Bible makes world history in its entirety a single transcendentally significant story with a well-defined plot pivoted on creation, fall, redemption, and judgment. That's C.S. Lewis saying that in the 1950s. That's a taxonomy, creation, fall, redemption, and judgment, that is often associated with people like Al Walters and his book Creation Regained. And you might be tempted to think that's a Dutch Reformed taxonomy, but it's actually not. It's quite transcend. It transcends a person's theological affiliation. In fact, you can find this construct in the Church Father Athanasius. So, but the point is that Genesis is a part of this single overarching story. And what is the story there to do but to situate us in this world that God made? To tell us how we got to where we are, and to tell us what it means to play our part from here on out. And the stuff that it, so the information that it gives is oriented towards that purpose. And we're left free to do a lot of the exploration of how these various things work. And I'll finish then with just thinking about the issue of the story. J.R.R. Tolkien, in one of his letters, I think it's to his son Christopher, said, "We all long for Eden." That's a feature of human life. The biblical story explains why that's so, why the yearning for Eden is a sense of loss, because there's something there's something that has changed the human situation, and regardless of how much imagery we want to attribute to the early chapters of Genesis, there's still this basic story of events that comes through. There you have a good creation, and you have it marred by rebellion against God, particularly human beings. And so you have a feature of human beings that they yearn for Eden. And of course, the Bible, by establishing, as it were, by naming the elephant in the room, also establishes then a willingness on the part of God's people to listen to God's solution for that yearning. And then what do we do with the Bible? It's sort of like the way that Frodo characterized the Red Book. When Frodo is leaving the Shire forever, I'm sorry if that's a spoiler to you, but it shouldn't be. I mean, how can you call yourself a human, civilized human being if you don't know the end of the story? But when Frodo is leaving the Shire forever, he entrusts the Red Book, which is the record of all these great events, the end of the Third Age and the beginning of the Fourth Age and so forth. He entrusts that Red Book to Sam and tells Sam, "And you will read things out of the Red Book and keep alive the memory of the age that is gone, so that people will remember the great danger and so love their beloved land all the more." The purpose of reading the Bible is then to see ourselves in that story where a great danger has confronted humankind, namely the danger of the everlasting loss of Eden. And you have a great victory that's been won, as we Christians profess in the death and the resurrection of Jesus. We think how, had God left things to themselves, it would have turned out otherwise, and it would have been horrible. But we are the beneficiaries of this great victory that has taken place. And it's something that we are called upon to treasure, to steward, and to pass on to the generations that follow. I'll stop there and see what kind of questions you might have.
Are your statements preserved in a finished book, or are you still working on it?
Well, as all of us who are research fellows are contractually obligated to produce some kind of academic writing that gives the results of our studies, I'm working on it. That's when I am spending my day, let's see, with this picture here. Yeah, I'm sorry, I just went to town with slides. That's so when that's what I do day to day is work on this, and I anticipate, you know, having it ready to send to a publisher within, you know, let me give it a year, you know. So that's what I'm doing. And I don't know what my colleagues are looking at. Each of us is taking a different tack on this.
I'll just say I can hardly wait to get my hands on it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Now the contract calls for us to produce an academic work or set of academic works. My wife is of the opinion that what I need to do is fulfill the contract and then rewrite it for the sake of a general audience, which, if God gives me strength, I would actually like to do that. We'll see. But thank you. Yes, sir.
I was curious about the aspect of good faith communication.
Yes.
And you know, if you could pull that out
right.
A little bit more. you know, I'm thinking about that a lot in terms of the context, God and these people.
Right.
Is that part of the...
Sure.
The
right.
Context?
So if I tell you, I have said to my children, okay, so when my children were small, when we first moved to St. Louis, we hadn't settled into a church and felt obligated to visit all the churches of our denomination, you know, which is terrible. I would not recommend that at all, but, you know, before we really settled in. And so one particular Sunday, my daughter was having a hard time at church and after church. You know, she really needed a nap. But she was not cognizant of that. What she was mostly concerned about was whether I was going to take her for a walk. And so I told her, okay, so after church, we're going to go home, we'll have lunch, and then we'll have a walk. Now, in my mind, I didn't need to tell her that there was also going to be a nap in between lunch and the walk. She didn't need to know that. But, you know, so did I tell her the truth? I told her the truth. You know, that was suitable for that communication event. And so I was acting in good faith. Had I told her that I was going to, buy her, ice cream or something like that when I didn't intend to, that would not be in good faith. And that's not a good faith communication. So we assume in most acts of communication, unless we have reason to think otherwise, we start by giving people the possibility that they're speaking to us in good faith. And so we interpret their truth or falsehood within the light of that at least that possibility. And so when I'm speaking to you in good faith, then what am I committing myself to? If I tell you, for example, supposing somebody I'm telling you that somebody is pregnant, I say she has a bun in the oven. Okay, you know enough to appreciate that's an image for a baby, as it were, being prepared, and you would not think that that somebody was a baker or that sort of thing. So the details of the locution itself, the words themselves, you know how to take them in a way that they are still that they're meaningful, and you can see them to be truthful. Now, it becomes difficult or challenging, say, if you're talking about things in the Bible, like the Genesis account. You've got and this is something that John is working on more than I am. You know, you have things that look like descriptions of the world. So I had a picture there. There we are. So, people will tell you that's the ancient view of the world. I think that there's some difficulties with that, just because it fails to account for poetical language. But supposing it is, can a person use that picture of the world in good faith to tell you true things? Certainly. So, for example, if you're in a third world or an underdeveloped country where people don't have a theory of nutrition and they have some other kind of theory of how foods work, they don't have a theory of nutrition that corresponds to ours, and they tell you that eating a certain thing will be bad for you, and they think it's bad for you, you know, say they're medievals and they think it's going to mess with your bodily humors or something like that. Their picture of the world might not be the one that you have, but you would not be wise to disregard what they're telling you. So they can still tell you things in good faith, even though a strict interpretation of their words might lead you to wonder whether they are seeing the same world as you are. So, and it's all or surrounds the question of, you know, what does it mean to say a statement is true? Yes, sir.
In your understanding, what is a lie?
Sorry?
In your understanding, what is a lie?
Well, a lie is a deliberate deception. Okay, so in Star Wars, right? So, Obi-Wan Kenobi told Luke that Darth Vader had killed his father, right? You're familiar with this, right? Okay, so I can't always be sure, you know. It's in the third of the original films. That's episode 6 now, you know, in the canon. And Luke learns that actually Darth Vader is his father. I suppose that's true. And he's talking to the ghost of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and he's complaining. He said, "You told me he killed my father." Obi-Wan says, "Well, what I told you is true from a certain point of view." And Luke's response is, "From a certain point of view?" He objects to that. There are limitations. Actually, if you look closely at the film footage, Alec Guinness in that scene cannot keep a straight face. He's got a smirk on his face because he knows as well as you and I do that his story, well, when the good man that was your father became Darth Vader, he as well as dying. Come on, that's not an adequate representation of the situation. So that would be a deceptive description. I'm not saying it wasn't serving a useful purpose. I'm just saying it's deception. Yes, ma'am.
The Pentateuch, the Torah.
Yes.
Have you explored how the Jews see that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Have I explored how the Jews see that? Yes.
And are you incorporating that into your work?
Yes. One of my favorite conversation partners is an Israeli series called Da'at Yikra, which basically Bible knowledge. That's how we would translate it in English. These are very, very, very careful and very traditional Jewish Israeli commentaries. So they not only work carefully with the text, but they also bring in how this has been treated in the Jewish tradition, you know, up as far as the medieval rabbis and so forth. Yes, because I think that it's important to pay attention to how other readers have dealt with the material. Even if I'm not going to agree with them, I still had better know what they've done. And if I'm not going to agree with them, I need a good reason. Yes, ma'am.
I think here within North America, it would be pretty easy to be able to discriminate between poetical language and analytical language. But I'm wondering, as you look at the biblical languages, what indicators do you find marking the differences, if you're able to do that clearly between them?
Well, there's virtually no scientific language in the Bible. You use scientific language for particular purposes. So, for example, the animals that are clean and unclean, it's very important to be specific about which animals are unclean. Now nobody knows for sure exactly which species or genera are being described by those animals, but the lists are quite detailed, lots of words that modern scholars have to guess at. But you know, places like that, you have to be very, very explicit. Or, you know, and lots of stuff in Leviticus has to be explicit because it's a manual for what to do in such a circumstance. Other things are just, you can tell that they're less explicit. That's just the subject matter. In Psalm 139 or Psalm 51, for example, there's a reflection on how an embryo grows in its mother's womb, but there's no technical discussion of how it came to be and so forth. It doesn't need to be. That's left for human investigation. It's usually pretty easy to discern just based on what it looks like this text is doing. And, then you might have to go through a few iterations. You try it, see how it works, and then you revise, and you can go back and forth a few times. Since I'm accustomed to systems engineering, I'm used to iterations, but before you sort of get onto the right value, and that's a part of the interpretive process. Yes, sir?
With the focus on the audience, how do you approach the way the audience changes as we get further and further away from the author? As Christian viewpoint, we're going to see Genesis one way. Second Temple Jew would see it another way. Jews during the exile would see it another way as you get there.
Right.
So does it change? Mm-hmm. How do you approach it?
Well, you start with the literary presentation in the Pentateuch. So the literary presentation has to do with Moses delivering this to the generation of people who are about to follow Joshua across the Jordan River. Okay, so that's the literary presentation. Whether you believe that or not is, that's just a totally separate question. So that gives you then the audience, that just like if you go to Tolkien, the way to read Tolkien sympathetically is to imagine yourself to be living in a world where hobbits are less common than they used to be. That's what it means to be a sympathetic reader. So you imagine yourself then in the situation of the generation that's going to follow Joshua. Now the culture in the period before the exile doesn't change all that much. Subsistence agriculture is the culture. Pretty much right the way through. You get the rise of an artisan class towards the end of the Judean state, and those people are exiled and so forth. But they're still a very small minority. So the generality of the people are subsistence agriculture. When they return from exile, that's still pretty much their lifestyle. So you're still talking about people who are close to the soil, who know animals, know plants. And whose major concern is how do we feed our family. Things do change because of the exile. Prior to the exile, you have, I mentioned subsistence agriculture. Well, that's why the Old Testament says so much about Baal and the other deities, because their promise is to guarantee regularity of the rains, productivity of the soil, and so forth. And if you are living on the edge every day of your life, you are tempted to hedge your bets. You're not thinking I'm going to abandon Yahweh, but I'll at least include these other guys. So there's a Bob Hope routine where he mentioned Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad. Said just to make sure I got everybody covered. That's the temptation. So the exile. At least according to Jewish historians, Israeli historians, pretty much removed the Canaanite type of idolatry from the people. But you still have the day-to-day question. How can I ensure the fertility of my land? So the concerns, are pretty much enduring throughout. One of the things that will change is the canon, the books that are added to the canon and so forth. I've realized in the last couple of days that one of the things I need to do and I'm trying to do is to show why the place within the canon is an important factor in our interpretation. But I'm just telling you I'm working on that. So, yes, sir?
Well, this is a question for a seminary professor. I haven't had training
an exegesis. So do you see this kind of work you're doing contributing to new approaches that can be taught to pastors as they read Scripture?
Right. Well, I hope so. And so if I fulfill my wife's wishes in writing something for the general audience, then that will be the fruit of it. You know, that there is, as I'm sure you're aware, there's this level of tension in our churches, uncertainty about the value of the sciences, and, you know, there's all these forces that are pulling people in different directions and so on. So, I mean, I've talked with, say, research biologists who tell me, I go to my lab and I don't feel I'm at home there because I'm a Christian. I go to church and I don't feel at home there because I'm a biologist. I think that I'd like to help people in the sciences, you know, do good critical thinking, but I'd also like to encourage an overall enthusiasm about the scientific enterprise amongst the general Christian public. The reason, you know, the thing about Genesis 1 in particular is it's become a locus of controversy. But its actual function in ancient Israel is that it's a celebration of what an achievement this creation is. What an amazing thing it is to be a human being. How awesome it is to be given this role of responsibility and to be commissioned to rule it in God's name with wisdom and benevolence. And, oh, I confront a world without wisdom and benevolence, but God offers it to me. I'd like to have it in order to carry out my human my human calling of ruling God's world with wisdom and benevolence. So I'd like to sort of shift the focus on Genesis 1 less to the controversies and more to the actual celebratory nature of the passage. I'm going to try. Yes, sir.
What would you do to deal with the possibility that with all of our sophistication in areas of science and engineering, that we may be right on the cusp of an entirely new paradigm. Just to mention one possibility, that we may live in an electric universe, not one that is governed entirely or even principally by gravity. Mm-hmm. There is a deference to people in the area of theology to bow to the old scientific paradigm. What if we were to grant the possibility that, well, so science? What's so good about science? In 10 years, our paradigm of science and cosmology may be entirely different from what it is today.
Well, probably 10 years is too short a timeline for that. I mean, just given the history of science. But basically, it's going to boil down to this. Now, this is a diagram one of my colleagues uses in class, so AJ will recognize this. He'll probably have a little PTSD as I put it on here. There's the creator and there's the creature. Okay, so... And the direction of communication is always down from the creator. What that means is that as a creature, I have no idea where we fit in the story. I have no idea what the significance of this particular scientific discovery is. I have no idea why that other driver cut me off. You know, I don't know how everything fits together. So I cannot predict the future. Is the paradigm going to change? I don't know. Paradigms usually change one funeral at a time is what they say. You know, so that's what doesn't change is your lived experience. Regardless of the paradigm, you still get up in the morning. You still are called to love your neighbor as yourself. Have to feed yourself and so forth. I mean, these things at the level of lived experience don't change. It's cool to talk about, you know, sort of the microcosm in there that, you know, I think this is a solid object, but it's actually space and all these interactive forces and so forth. But at the level of lived experience, that's a solid. And that's not going to change with the scientific paradigm. And, you know, so that's, and that's the level towards which the Bible directs our attention. Yes, sir?
Someone asked you what constitutes a lie, and I think your reply was something to the effect that it was the intention to deceive that mm-hmm. made a thing a lie. If that's the case, then a lie is not synonymous with untruth if the speaker mm-hmm. is mistaken.
Right, right. That was very important. No, I'm not going to get into politics. Sorry. I'm not going to go there. But, yeah, a mistake is different from a lie. Certainly it is. I think that's, at least in my moral universe, that's true. Yes. Yes?
So following up on that, when you told your daughter that there was going to be lunch and then a walk,
mm-hmm.
is that intended?
Had I led her to believe that the walk would follow directly after the lunch, that would have been untrue. I did not lead her to believe that, and she will testify. you can narrate a sequence of events and leave stuff out. Without telling an untruth. And you can predict a sequence of events and leave stuff out without telling an untruth.
Can leaving things out be deceitful?
Sometimes. If they're important to the communication, yes, they are. And children do that all the time, when they're being questioned. Okay, so how did this mess get to be on the floor? Well, there was this vase and that was, it just fell. They leave out the horsing around and so, yeah, that, of course. You go on a case-by-case basis, though. So the mere existence of leaving something out is not evidence of telling a falsehood. Yes, sir.
The slide you showed with a tree, with a snake and a man,
mm-hmm.
what does that tell about the story of who fathered the children? Anything?
Let's see. Let's get that story.
Walton's book.
I'm not remembering where I put that slide. I'm sorry.
It's farther down. I think you're getting close.
Was it farther down? Oh, it was, because I was talking about the story, wasn't I? Yeah. Uh-oh. Yeah, that's a bad move there. All right, so, okay, it's all your fault for asking me that question.
There
we are.
The tree. Snake?
Oh. I messed it up, didn't I? I'm sorry.
Didn't mean to ask such a question.
I know, but it's totally your fault, isn't it? Now, see, in good faith communication, one appreciates that that's banter rather than an actual attribution of blame, you see. So,
but we all remember the slide. What's your answer about it?
Okay, so this one here. So the children... Which children are we talking about here?
Angels.
Oh, yeah, so this is an angel who's banishing them from the garden. So that's just a pictorial representation of Adam and Eve, their temptation, fall, and then banishment. So it's one thing to say that these are actual events. And to say that this is the divinely approved way of visualizing these events, which a Christian will say. What exactly those events would have been had you been there, what would have looked like had you been there to see them, that's a topic for discussion that doesn't change whether these are actual events. Because you can portray, just like my Horatio at the bridge battle, I can portray an actual set of events with pictures and still be telling the truth.
I wonder if this would be a good time to move into just sort of conversation after the more formal presentation and question and answer. So thank you very much.